Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Star Entertainment Group Full Year Financial Results 2020. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the speaker's presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session, at which time, if you wish to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand the conference over to your first speaker today, Mr. Matt Bethier, Managing Director and Chief Executive Officer. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Rochelle, and good morning, everybody. I'm here today with Harry Theodore, our CFO, to take you through the Star Entertainment results presentation. Let me start with the highlights of this year, and I really want to stress 3 points to you. First of all, we had good momentum going into this crisis, really on the back of the cost out program that we executed in the first quarter of last year. Secondly, during the crisis, we did everything humanly possible to take our costs as quickly as possible and look after our people at the same time. And thirdly, now that we're coming to the end of it, hopefully, we are very well placed to take advantage of all of the pent-up demand that we're seeing. So on the first point, as you may recall from the first half, we had good broad-based momentum leading into a shutdown in March. 8 months into the year, EBITDA was up 12.1% on the PCP and accelerating. The earnings growth was driven by the full rate, better run rate benefits that we're getting out of the fixed cost reduction program that we ran in Q1, and that gave us strong margin expansion. Particularly pleasing was the performance of our Gold Coast property, where we delivered record earnings in the first half and grew even faster in January and February. We were on track to essentially double the earnings from 5 years before, which is very positive. When we had to shut down our properties on the 23rd of March, we responded aggressively to steady the ship. We reduced the cost base from around $90 million a month to $10 million within 4 weeks by standing down some 8,600 staff, implementing pay reductions for senior staff and directors, and cutting into all non-critical and non-labor cost elements. We reduced CapEx, we deferred dividends that had already been declared, and introduced an underwrite to avoid the cash outflows. Then we secured additional liquidity and obtained covenant waivers from our lenders to give us even more runway. We then delivered on a bunch of important strategic objectives during the shutdown. We secured a positive outcome on our tax negotiation with New South Wales and secured long-term slots exclusivity for casinos in New South Wales, for our casino in New South Wales. We revived the prospects for further development and increased density in around Pyrmont, where our Sydney property is. We delivered the Sovereign Room in Sydney on time and on budget. We were successful in having the process for a second casino in the Gold Coast formally terminated, and we secured $1.6 billion worth of project financing for Queen's Wharf on very favorable terms. That project is now fully funded. In addition to all of that, all the capital project progress without any interruption. Now, not being able to trade for a quarter has obviously been very detrimental for us in terms of the underlying results and the one-off costs that have been caused by this disruption. At the normalized level, we reported NPAT of $120.8 million, down 46%, and at the statutory level, we made a loss of $94.6 million. Now, where we stand today is in a much better place than we were in March. First of all, we have very substantial liquidity on hand. Secondly, the business is open and trading again, even though there are still some restrictions in our locations. In July, we generated meaningful positive cash flows, even after CapEx and JV contributions, even without the JobKeeper payment. And that's essentially because our loyalty customer base is trading in line with last year, and we're keeping expenses very tight by managing a number of staff that we bring back. So the benefits from the cost out program from last year are locked in, and now we're making sure that there's no cost creeping in. What we're seeing in terms of revenue is that not all customers are coming back. Some that we talk to say that they're just not comfortable about coming back into crowded places. But the ones that are coming back are spending up. And they're spending up in our gaming rooms, but they're also spending up in our restaurants. and they've been doing this now for the last 10 weeks. So we think this is an indication that this return of the customers is a very robust event. Queensland is performing well across the board and doing even better in August than in July. Sydney had started strongly, particularly in the new sovereign room, but now revenues are weaker due to the more severe capacity restrictions, which basically mean we can only have 300 people per room. The international business is stalling and will remain for the next 12 months. But in aggregate, it's fair to say that we are quite buoyed by the trading patterns we can see, as they demonstrate the resilience of the category. Essentially, with minimum marketing stimulus, we can fill up all the capacity we're allowed to open under the health orders. So this bodes well as restrictions are eased. Let me now hand over to Harry to take you through the finer points of the financial presentation.
Great. Thanks, Matt, and good morning, everyone. I was going to touch on each of costs, CapEx, and balance sheet. Starting on costs, I've got 4 points. Firstly, as Matt said, if you look at FY20 for the period prior to COVID, we were pleased with how costs were tracking. Matt referenced the cost out program, which is embedded and was delivering $45 million of annual savings to the costs prior to COVID. Secondly, when COVID hit, as Matt said, we responded swiftly to temporarily reduce costs both on a variable and fixed basis and minimize the cash burn. We were able to get costs down to $10 million per month over April and May. Thirdly, as we've reopened, we're really focused on variabilizing the cost base as much as possible and bringing back only the costs that we really require given the scope and scale of operations open. For some context, taking July, at the current scale of operations, we're about half of the operating costs compared to last year. This includes the benefit of the JobKeeper subsidy that we retain on staff that has stood up and earning at least $1,500 per fortnight. Even without JobKeeper, we're running OPEX at about 60% of prior year. So this approach to cost has really allowed us to maintain domestic business margins, even with only 75% of the domestic revenue back. And that excludes the JobKeeper benefit. With JobKeeper, the margins are materially better than prior year. Lastly, in addition to the cost focus on reopening, we're also looking at further opportunities to restructure the cost base and make a permanent reduction in fixed costs across the business. We took the opportunity to restructure the VIP business team and associated areas in July. That will drive a $10 million annualized cost benefit. We also have a program underway to look at non-VIP areas of the business, and we'll be in a position to update the market at the half-year results on the materiality of savings generated and where they're coming from. Now turning to CapEx, the key message on CapEx, in addition to projects continuing to track on time and budget, is CapEx is now reducing. We've reviewed the range of projects in light of COVID and reduced scope or amended timing. So on balance sheet, we're budgeting CapEx of about $100 million in FY21. After 21, we still expect CapEx stays below D&A for some time, which we highlight on the chart on slide 17. Increasingly now, looking forward, our growth projects are more in capital-light JV models, which are largely funded. Lastly, I'll just turn to balance sheet and funding. From a funding and liquidity perspective, I'd say we're in good shape. We have around $600 million of cash and undrawn facilities, as Matt mentioned. In July, we've returned to materially cash flow positive results, and based on trading in August so far, we'd expect that to be the case for this month as well. We've now fully funded and got locked in funding for our two JV projects under construction. So the funding and liquidity is in place with a lot of progress made over the course of FY20. Our gearing is elevated though, so we finished at 30 June with normalised net debt to EBITDA of 3.2 times. And that really just reflects the impact COVID has had on the business over the course of the second half of FY20. We spent a fair bit of time looking at balance sheet, and we've got a plan to reduce debt in 21 and remain confident that the plan maintains an appropriate level of gearing for our business given the operating environment. We've provided a sources and uses of funds table on slide 14. The key point here is we expect that asset sales that we're pursuing this year and the collection of receivables in 21 could more than cover CapEx, JV contributions, and funding costs, given we're not paying a cash dividend until gearing returns below 2.5 times. that leaves a significant portion of the operating cash flows to repay debt in 2021. I'll hand back now to Matt to cover off on the priorities.
Thank you, Harry. The key message on our strategy is we continue to believe it's the right direction forward. Of course, we're modifying our operations in some areas in the short term to respond to the restricted operating environment. For example, we're selling a boat and a plane, and we're skewing our marketing towards attracting domestic customers and mostly cash customers into our hotels rather than comping gaming customers exclusively. The focus of the strategy remains unchanged, and that's really three things. We want to deliver on growth in a capital-light manner. We want to demonstrate operational leadership in critical areas such as gaming and loyalty, and we want to deliver on our development projects. Financially, as Harry said, this means that this year we'll seek to restore the balance sheet through debt reduction, cash preservation, and capital recycling. We're also pursuing a claim against insurers who have provided our business interruption insurance. A new aspect for us will be the competition in table games in Sydney from the middle of this financial year. We've had a lot of time to prepare for this, and I'm pleased to say that we're ready for competition. The new Sovereign Room that we opened formally in August, early in August, is a world-class asset that has been very well received by our guests, and it plays a critical part in the way we think about our competition. On page 24 of the presentation, we set out that that's only one part of our defense, or as I like to think about it, our attack, because we have thought hard and have prepared every aspect of our customer interaction to be ready for our competition. On pages 25 and 26, we touch on the major capital projects underway. As Harry mentioned, apart from the funding being secured and all of those, it's now a much less risky and scary profile because these projects are heading towards the end of their development phase, and the larger and larger components of the project have been built and have been let to builders at fixed prices or lump sum contracts. In Brisbane, we're now over 75% of the construction costs let with the contingency fully intact. That bodes well for the future and presents a much less risky profile for the residual CapEx because they're all joint venture capital developments. These are the main points that we wanted to cover in this presentation. Rochelle, I'm giving back to you. Can I ask you to now open the line up for any questions that investors might have?
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone keypad and wait for your name to be announced. In the interest of time, we ask that only one question be prepared per announcement, and speakers reserve the right to proceed afterwards. If you wish to ask another question, you may press star one again and wait for your name to be announced. The first question comes from the line of Desmond Tsao of Goldman Sachs. Please ask your question.
Oh, thanks, and good morning. Just a question around the potential asset sales and the VIP collections that you guys highlight on slide 14. Just interested in sort of the timing on that. Obviously, the Sydney car park has been sort of a potential sale that you've been flagged for some time now. Just any further color around that would be great, and as well as anything you can add on the insurance claim side of things, I think, which you first raised a couple of months ago. Cheers.
Thanks, Desmond. I'll start on the asset sales. Look, you're right. The Sydney car park sale process was something that we started early in the calendar year. We started with a registration of interest phase. We received those and then decided when COVID hit and the properties were shut down, we put the process on hold, but we re-engaged and started expressions of interest in July. That is an active process now. Look, given it's an active process, there's probably not a huge amount more to say on it, but it's something that we're committed to and we're pursuing, and we'd expect resolution definitely in this financial year on the car park sale.
First half.
Probably in the first half, but it'll depend on how we go in terms of the way the expressions of interest come in. Do you want to talk about business interruption?
I should just say, at this point, we continue to look pretty good in terms of the interest from investors and the ranges that we're talking to them about in terms of capital. On the business interruption insurance, you know, this is obviously not a slam dunk, but we think we have a reasonable position. This is not a pandemic claim, right? Because we have an insurance policy and wording that creates very specific opportunities around the nature of the shutdown that was forced on us. And so on that basis, we think we've got a reasonable prospect.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Look, just on the receivables, sorry, which you asked as well. Look, the timing on that, they will flow through, we would expect, over the course of the year. Sitting here, we've already collected about 30% of the balance in July, August. The predictability then month on month is a little bit difficult, but, you know, we'd expect over the course of the year to get at least that 50 million that we've put in the slot.
Okay, that's great.
Next question comes from the line of Matt Ryan from UBS. Please ask your question.
Hi, Matt. Hi, Harry. Just hoping if you could talk us through the conversations that you've had with your lenders for the next covenant testing date, and maybe if you could talk a little bit about what their priorities or messages were with you when you went to them for relief earlier this year.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Matt. Look, as you would already know, we sought waivers for the June period in April, which we received. As part of that process, we have made certain commitments. A big one is the dividend. So we've committed to the lenders not to pay any cash dividends until gearing returns to 2.5 times or lower. Look, that was a substantial commitment around as the properties reopened and started generating cash flows, gave the lenders a large amount of confidence that the business had a plan to de-gear, and we're fully committed to that. We're doing monthly reporting to the lenders now that we're reopened. I'd say from where we were in April, May, things are looking a lot better than some of the scenarios we were looking at. So we've reopened relatively early, Sydney on a restricted basis in June, and then a more substantial reopening in July across the properties. As we mentioned in the early comments, the trading has been positive. There's definitely been strong demand coming back across all properties as we've reopened, and what we've been able to do on the cost base has really preserved quite a significant level of profitability, even with the operating restrictions that are in place across the properties. So, you know, sitting at this point in time, I think that positive cash flow momentum really sets us up well for any support we need in future periods from the lending group. I would also say across all the lenders, they're long-term relationships for us. So virtually all of the lenders, whether they're the note holders or our bank, you know, really been with the business for a long period of time. And there's a strong relationship there that we feel comfortable, you know, we can work with them to get support given the temporary impacts we're seeing on the business from COVID.
Mm. And do you feel like there's an understanding that you own or lease, you know, hard assets and you've got long-term licenses and so on? Are they sort of receptive of those qualities versus maybe some other companies that don't have that?
Look, definitely. And I think that was reflected in how successful we were in bringing the operating costs down to a very minimal level when the properties were shut. So we don't lease, and when we say lease, we may lease the land, but we're making very minimal fixed lease payments across the property. So that allowed us to really preserve cash and capital when we were shut down. And as we're reopening, that point around having hard assets and having a licensed profile and market structure where when the restrictions are eased, the customers come back with a strong demand profile. Yeah, that's very key, I think, for the lenders, being able to get comfortable, you know, as with investors, that as the restrictions ease, the temporary impact really rolls off and the properties return to a good level of earnings and good level of cash flow.
Thanks, guys.
Your next question comes from the line of Anthony Longo of CLSA. Please ask your question.
Oh, good morning, Matt. Good morning, Harry. Just a quick one on the CapEx. It looks like it's a pretty meaningful reduction in the amount that you're looking to spend over the next little bit, so 75 mil, for instance. Are you able to give a sense as to, I mean, to the extent you can answer the question, where that's ultimately going to be coming from? And then I guess the second prong to that, is that something that you would affect your competitive positioning as well?
Thank you, Anthony. Look, the bulk of the capital reduction comes out of F&B development. So in the medium-term plan that we had, we had more aggressive plans to put out more F&B. We scaled those plans back. And that's just a reflection of, you know, the medium-term demand expectations. So my wine bar that I've been begging people for the last 5 years has just been kicked down the road for a little bit longer. Look, we would have only developed these things if they've added to the property, but in the short term, we think it's more prudent to just hold back on that investment. And if you look, if we're wrong and the world turns around very quickly and everybody gets vaccinated and people are banging at our doors at Christmas, we can dial that up again pretty quickly. We have nothing, you know, the nice thing about our assets now is we have a lot of space that is ready to just be built out, whether it's in the Gold Coast or in Sydney. We don't have to do any more structural stuff for the foreseeable future. It's just banging out a few more restaurants and bars. So that places as well. But we're just being cautious.
It's fair to say, Anthony, as well, you know, we've come off a period where we've invested very heavily in the properties. And as Matt said, part of that investment was to build capacity, which we now have the opportunity to grow into over the next few years. But it also has meant across Sydney and Gold Coast in particular, they're two very fresh properties that from a competitive positioning perspective, you know, the investment's been made up front that the properties are in good shape to compete effectively in both markets.
That's great. And sorry, just maybe one follow-up on costs. I know you're looking to update the market later on, but just wanted to get a sense as to, or perhaps commentary with respect to the previous plan that you've done. So I'm just trying to get a sense that, you know, you've obviously done a pretty meaningful cost out program already, so I'm just sort of wondering, and your OPEX growth was largely flat as it is, just trying to get a sense as to where some opportunities may be on that front, to the extent you can comment.
Look, maybe I'll start and Matt can add to it. The first cost out program was $350 million, and it was focused purely on corporate and salaried overhead roles. So there was about 2,500 roles at the time that we reviewed to generate those cost savings where we found 350 heads. There was a change in the organizational structure, which Matt's talked about on previous calls with the centers of excellence, that really supported a new way of working that aligned with that headcount reduction. And look, we were very happy with how the organization was functioning with that reduced headcount and that new organizational structure. So we were looking that was fully embedded and supported with how the corporate and properties were functioning. This opportunity is probably going to look a bit broader. So, you know, across the group, we've got 9,000 staff. There are other areas of overhead that weren't reviewed in the previous plan. We've also, now that the organizational structure is embedded, we'll have another look at where there's additional opportunities. So it'll be a bit of a broad program, but obviously, you know, we're not going to give specific numbers at this point in time, but by the time of the first half result, we'll be in a position to give you a sense of how much savings and where they're coming from and why we think they're appropriate and sustainable.
I would just say, Anthony, the trading environment, obviously, we have a whole bunch of variable cost, right? So, which varies with volumes. That is relatively easy for us to deal with. What Harry is really referencing is the structures above that, where, you know, the harder cost to get to, but we're getting good progress and some of it, it relates to technology that gives us the opportunity to, for example, change the levels and the number of supervisors required. And we're working through these opportunities now. But there's more we can do.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Harry, and congrats on the result.
Thank you.
The next question comes from the line of David Tadris of Macquarie. Please ask your question.
Oh, hi, Matt. Hi, Harry. I know it's early days, but can you talk about how the new sovereign resort in Sydney is going? And I guess I wanted to think about competition in the Sydney market as well. It looks like Crown's going to pivot its strategy to more domestic focus given the impact on VIP because of COVID. So can you sort of talk through those two issues?
Well, so the early numbers on the sovereign room are very strong. And it's, you know, it's really encouraging to see the customers responded to it. As I said, you know, we obviously have very good visibility over customers on a name-by-name basis, and it's given us insights into who's coming, who's not coming, once they're coming, how has their play changed. And a big chunk of that then leads into the Crown Defense strategies, which essentially are, you know, for the top players, are almost like individual account strategies to make it attractive for these players to continue to stay with us. Rounded up by a whole bunch of, you know, other things that we know that they like to do, and we need to impress on them that, you know, that those things come together in our location in a better way than elsewhere. So I don't really want to go into too much detail of how we do that, but we do have new technology in the room, which is interesting and extremely insightful for us. So as part of the upgrade of the sovereign room, we have implemented smart tables that combine RFID technology with optical readers of bets, which give us insights into bet types, bet patterns, bet preferences by player, which is an extremely rich source of information for us that feeds into loyalty. So we're pretty excited about what we're seeing. And we're not cocky, but confident that we know how we will deal with competition.
Gotcha. And just one more question from me. I mean, just thinking about other developments beyond Queens Wharf, Brisbane, and Gold Coast Tower 1, I think there's been some planning changes at Pyrmont recently. So maybe the Ritz-Carlton's back in play. And where are you at with Gold Coast Tower 2?
Maybe starting with Tower 2, so we're in the pre-sale phase of the apartments. That's been continuing. Obviously, COVID's had some impact there and it's slowed down a little bit, but, you know, on the current trajectory, we expect that is a tower that probably will move forward because we're getting enough sales where it's in the range, but still got a little bit of time to go. So we'll make a decision on that in this current half, and it will depend on how the sales go in the next few months. Look, with Pyrmont, it's a bit of early days, but the government has released a master plan for Pyrmont that is currently getting public consultation. It does provide for some higher density development at our property and this part of Pyrmont that our property is in, which is encouraging. We'll participate in that process. You know, ultimately, we expect by the end of the calendar year that under this process, there will be a new planning framework in Pyrmont that, you know, would allow us over time to develop out our property and add more capacity in terms of hotel, food and beverage and other amenities.
David, the thing that's important in these towers, they're joint venture mixed-use towers, right? So the equity contribution to get one of those towers up is, you know, not a lot of money because the pre-sale of the apartments or the sale of the apartments essentially funds the towers on our modeling. All we do is provide the equity with our partners, a share of the equity to get the tower going, then we get it repaid. So it's a very capital-light approach. And even if you get the Ritz-Carlton back, that is not going to be a massive capital requirement.
Gotcha. That's clear. Thanks for running through that with me.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Bryan Raymond from Citi. Please ask your question.
Good morning. I'm just interested in understanding the monthly cash generation that you guys are seeing currently. Obviously, there'd be a bit of a drag there from the VIP side, but domestic should be generating, I would have thought, decent profitability and cash generation at the moment. And then you've obviously got the drag from CapEx going into Queen's Wharf. So I'm just trying to really evaluate that liquidity position against where you're sort of tracking month to month at the moment. And then if you could comment around what that means for potential capital raising, which you obviously haven't done today, and that's assuming you don't have to close again or there's no other outbreak in Sydney or any other sort of left field event. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. I'll start off. Look, you mentioned the VIP business. So in terms of cash generation, the business we have now is almost entirely domestic. We've only got 5% of VIP volumes, and they're largely cash customers anyway. So the profile of business is it's pretty much entirely cash and domestic business at the moment. From a cash flow perspective, that's quite a positive, because generally with VIP, the customer comes, sometimes they win and you pay them. When they lose, the majority are on credit and you receive repayment of the credit over a period of time. So the VIP business generally has a negative working capital, whereas the rest of the business has positive working capital, where the cash comes in up front and some of the costs associated with generating that revenue lag. So what we're seeing as we've reopened and the focus is purely cash and domestic, there's clearly very strong cash flow that's being generated from the business and a bit of benefit from that positive working capital coming in. We've also got some receivables from last year that are flowing through, like JobKeeper we pay up front and receive later. There's about $20 million sitting on the balance sheet at 30 June of prepayments to staff from JobKeeper that we then receive in July, and that will continue to roll for the next few months. There's also some prepayment of gaming tax in New South Wales because of the super tax structure. We obviously paid a higher level of tax than what we ended up needing to pay after the shutdown. So we prepaid some tax in 20 that flows into 21. So what we're seeing with that domestic business profile and some of the measures on a cash flow perspective is actually in July we've been able to pay a material amount of debt back, and we'd expect in August it looks quite similar based on current volumes. Look, in terms of the CapEx, the $100 million on balance sheet is phased relatively evenly month on month. The joint venture CapEx is low in this quarter, so when we locked in the funding for Queen's Wharf, we've been pre-funding into Queen's Wharf equity, so we had a requirement to keep an equity balance for that project at the joint venture level until the funding was locked in. When we locked the funding in June, that's allowed us to draw down that equity balance in the joint venture, so we're not forecasting to need to make any equity contributions into Queen's Wharf till post-October. So generally in this quarter, we're going to generate very strong cash flow. And then obviously we're pursuing the asset sales and some other things that could materially impact cash flow in a particular month.
Okay, there's a lot of moving parts there. I appreciate the colour. I mean, how does it all sort of stack up in aggregate? I mean, there's a few that are unquantified and a few that we can work out. Is there? It sounds like you're in a net positive position even after all that CapEx. Is that
To give you a sense, we tried to give you the sources and uses of funds that I mentioned in the slide. Look, in aggregate for the year, that's probably your best indication of the key cash out and cash in that we're forecasting for this year. Clearly, we haven't given you an earnings forecast for the year, which we typically don't do, but you can all make the estimates. But what we've given you is some colour on how strong July is based on the revenue and what we're doing in costs in terms of flowing through to EBITDA and profitability.
The only other point to make, Harry, is probably so our constructive engagement with the banks is not contingent on any asset sales. And the asset sales is icing on the top.
Right. And just to finalise this area, I mean the covenant the upcoming covenants for December and June next year. Are you still seeking waivers there? I'm just trying to recall where you're up to on that, and whether there's, or whether you won't need it and you're actually going to be okay on their
measures. We're likely to need it. It's not definitive, but we're likely to. So we're constructively engaging now with the banks to get support that we need proactively.
Okay, great. Thanks.
The next question comes from the line of Larry Gandler from Credit Suisse. Please ask your question.
Thanks, guys. That's a good segue into the first of my questions is, in terms of your leverage ratio, clearly you're going to be driving it down from 3.2 times. Where do you think, where do you want it for FY21? And what's your general target, if you can remind me of that?
Look, FY21 is still potentially going to be an abnormal year, Larry. So we're looking into FY22. And look, it's very hard to predict with the virus how it plays out. But, what we're seeing in 20 and early part of 21 is an abnormal period of trading and a temporary disruption, right? That's how we look at it. I think to the point that one of the previous questions was, we've got hard assets, we've got licenses that we know resonate with customers and will return to more normal levels of activity at a point in time. If you look at the profile of business, we've always said we're comfortable through the cycle of gearing between 2 times and 2.5 times. Generally, we don't gear the VIP earnings at all, and the part of the business that can carry the high gearing is domestic. Now, as we look at where the business has been performing well, where most of the earnings are coming from, domestic was already growing to 90% plus of the EBITDA in our view. That probably allows you to support a gearing level more at the higher end of that range. But at points in time, you may peak above that based on the circumstances at that point in time. What I would say with the plan that we have, we're comfortable that the gearing comes back down to a level that is appropriate for the business mix and outlook that we see.
By FY22.
Yep.
Yep. Okay, great.
And that's the conversation we're having with the banks. And as Harry said, they understand that. And, we've been banging on a little bit about the material cash flow in the early periods. The banks can see that money being put to debt reduction. And that's why the discussions are constructive. And, the banks are seeing a consistent support for our position, through the actions that we're taking.
Okay, great. I'll continue with my questions. My daughter decided to vacuum her room just at this moment, so you can cut the background noise there. Hazard of COVID. In terms of, operating performance in July, it's clearly been quite strong. Now, there's some things that your customers are obviously benefiting from, lack of alternative options in terms of travel and maybe entertainment. And some might even be benefiting from stimulus payments. To what extent are you guys intensely recycling your existing narrow loyalty base? And, as we kind of see some of these options for customers open up in terms of their spend or stimulus to diminish, do you sort of expect that trading will sort of weaken over time? And how can you measure whether your loyalty customers are, getting wallet fatigue, let's call it that?
Yeah. Look, Larry, the benefit that we have is a customer-by-customer visibility of their long-term spend. And we put a chart into the presentation that says, our loyalty customers are essentially spending at the level that they spent last year. And while not everybody is back, and, particularly when you first open up, there's a burst of exuberance, the patterns that we're now seeing are pretty consistent. Now the customers that's driving that business is not somebody who's on JobKeeper. These are customers that are from quite a different wealth segment. So I'm probably a little bit more optimistic than you are. Now,
you know, if the world turns to custard and we have to go back into shutdown and, you know, this massive, you know, economic disruption across the country, of course that's going to impact on us. But it is more of a gradual, we're climbing out of this hole now bit by bit. I think we should be pretty well placed.
Sure. So the customer base is not has narrowed to this group of customers that is, you know, perhaps wealthier. And you're perhaps intensely you reduce your overall marketing, but you must be encouraging their visitation. So to what point do these particular customers, you know, get wallet fatigue? Is there a way to measure that?
Yes, there is. And I can assure you that we are not overstimulating this segment. So, you know, we're not running at 100% of revenues, right? So we are capacity restricted. So I'd love to take additional customers, let additional customers into the property. You know, early in July, we had a campaign in Sydney where we had, you know, fewer restrictions, where we went above the line, and visitation popped almost overnight. So there is, you know, we know there's levers we can pull to bring additional players to the property, you know, when they're ready. For the time being, you know, the best way of maintaining a level of income is to work with the customers, or regular customers anyway.
Yeah. Okay. No,
we've talked about this before, Larry. These are customers who have a pattern of, in the past, coming, you know, once or twice a week anyway.
Mm. Okay, that's very clear. No, it's good.
Thank you.
Okay, appreciate it.
Your next question comes from the line of Ron Sundram of MSB. Please ask your question.
Hi, Matt and Harry. A couple of questions. Firstly, with the new restrictions in Sydney, the 300 maximum per room, are you able to give a bit of an indication of what that means in terms of how many patrons you can actually have in the property at any one time?
Yeah, we have a maximum of 1,800. And that compares to, you know, a normal visitation in Sydney prior to that would have been around about 25 to 30,000, which means probably a maximum of 10 to 12,000 visitors on property at any moment in time.
Okay. And on the main floor, how much are you able to segment that to get more than 300 or in the most compliant way?
Look, we could segment further, but I think the point is we don't want to push the boundaries here. You know,
sure.
The last thing anybody wants is to, you know, create trouble with our regulators, the health authorities, or, you know, be one of the reasons why there's a new lockdown in Sydney. So, look, we've taken a very conservative approach. We continue to turn every second slot machine off. We do all kinds of stuff that we probably wouldn't have to do, that I know other people are not doing. We just want to be conservative. This will serve us much better if we find a pathway to gradually climb out of here.
Okay, understood. And just taking into account what you said earlier around the maximum 10 to 12K pre-COVID, does the maximum of 1,800 have any meaningful impact midweek, daytime?
No.
Okay.
So if you came in right now, the answer is no. Sorry, Eric. But because the main floor is segmented into three areas and the health restrictions ban movements between these three areas, and you're only allowed to visit an area once in 24 hours, that then restricts how much time you spend there, because you can't go across, you know, you can't go to multiple bars and different types of games. So it is quite a narrow experience on the main gaming floor.
Yeah, it's not just the customer numbers, it's the other conditions that are challenging at this point in time. But, you know, clearly we are, as Matt said, very focused on being compliant and operating in a safe manner that, you know, deals with those restrictions.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Your next question comes from the line of Sasha Krien of Evans and Partners. Please ask your question.
Good morning, Matt and Harry. I think I'm last in the queue again. Just hoping you can give me a bit of a sense of where gaming revenues got to in Sydney for the short period when you were operating under the previous stage when you had looser restrictions. Not sure what stage number that was.
Oh, look, Sasha, because it was only a small amount of time, I don't think we should start breaking it down week by week. We obviously also had a suspected case in Sydney before the restrictions, and so there was a bit of news flow around that. So, you know, it's moved around a bit. We're not going to start to give sort of week by week trading.
Okay, fair enough. And then second question, just on these potential non-VIP cost savings, I'm just wondering, are you factoring in any cost increases from increased competition in the market when Crown comes into the market, you know, around marketing and promotions?
Look, this is a program that's looking at what the costs would be and looking to get some overhead savings in specific areas. So I'm not sure the two are linked. In terms of just what happens to marketing costs when Crown comes in, look, that's sort of a competitive positioning point that I don't think we're going to give any colour on what happens in that side or how we approach it. What I would say, though, it's a finite customer segment, right? We're talking about there's no slots, it's tables only, and it's tables in one category of customer. As Matt said, we've got a plan there that includes not just the sovereign room investment, but a whole range of factors. And, you know, we're very focused on being as competitive as we can be.
Yeah. Okay. I'll try very quickly for one more. Just, I think, Harry, you said previously on the asset sales that you won't pursue these asset sales unless their earnings are accretive. Yeah. Is that still the plan?
Yeah, definitely is. Look, obviously, we, in the short term, would retain the capital to reduce gearing, you know, but over time, that capital will be recycled because, you know, when we look at the profile of the balance sheet, all the measures we've taken in FY20 and what we're doing with the cost base and CapEx going forward and the dividend going forward, you know, this would be capital that, as Matt said, isn't part of necessarily a waiver of covenants or, you know, in the long-term de-gearing. We're doing that through the base plan. This would be additional capital we can recycle, and on that basis, you know, when we do recycle the capital, it will definitely be an easy credit.
So it won't be accretive until it's recycled. So that's very
well. It's very hard, right? At the current cost of debt, you would need an extremely high multiple. But you know, this is not permanent capital that we think we need to retain. This is capital that we will do something with, you know, when conditions return to normal.
So Sasha, the you know, our CapEx profile is just this inverted hockey stick where we now basically spend all the CapEx on our own balance sheet from here, and it's all joint venture capital going forward. Once Queen's Wharf opens up, our earnings will pop, will be substantially above DNA. We'd always said that by 22, 23, we'll have to think of, you know, what we do with the excess cash flow. You know, that goes into the same category. It's just against the starker background of, you know, we lost a quarter's worth of revenue and earnings.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Thank you.
There are no further questions at this time. I would now like to hand the call back to the speakers for any closing remarks.
Look, the final remarks is thank you for your time. I realize today is a big day for all of you. So thank you for your time, and I look forward to talking one-on-one with you over the next couple of days. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks,
ladies,
operator.
Gentlemen, you're welcome. Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may now all disconnect.